Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Ever wonder what really happens behind the scenes in construction, real estate, and development? We pull back the curtain on the new home construction industry, the real estate market, and the trends shaping it all. Discover the stories, insights, and expertise behind the process of building a new home. Join us for Trust the Process podcast, and let's build something great together.
If we were to drop an alien into any major U.S. city and you said, "Believe it or not, one of our scarcest assets as a city is our land," they would beam you up and shoot you into a comet.
Especially in a state like Nevada, where you can get in the car and drive from here to Reno, northern Nevada, southern Nevada, and it's nothing but land.
But you can. Right. So it's something that I get asked a lot just in passing among friends and colleagues and people in the industry and people that I interact with. It's why is it said that there's a land shortage? So there's a lot of factors at play here. No one wants to live in a house with no running water. No one wants to live in a house with no electricity. So if you look at what limits a lot of development on the East Coast, it's a fragmented land ownership, right? Because all of that land is spoken for. Someone owns it. Most land east of the Mississippi is owned by private parties, unless it's some sort of wildlife preserve or something that was maybe donated or something that was part of Teddy Roosevelt's push for national parks. And there's definitely federal land east of the Mississippi. But for the most part, land that is being developed east of the Mississippi was bought by a private citizen and developed. But why does all the raw land not just get developed then? What props up New York housing prices when there's so much raw land on Long Island, when there's so much in Eastern Pennsylvania that could be a wonderful master plan suburb for New York City? Well, a lot of it is infrastructure and the grid and the water grid. I mean, not just the power grid. What does the water supply look like? What do we do with waste? What do we do with streets? Where's the political will to spend money on improving the roads and then making another exit ramp for a 1,000 rooftop master plan community outside of Philadelphia? Well, there's not much political will, right? Because people will say, why can't you improve my street corner? Why can't you improve my schools? Why are we building a new school for this community? So it is the land, but is that land viable? Does that pencil out? If you're building that subdivision, let's say you're a master plan developer and you're putting 1,000 or 2,000 rooftops in, which school district are they going to go to? Are you going to fund those schools? Does the project still pencil if you do all that? Can you assemble enough land to make all that work? Can you assemble the capital? Can you deploy the capital? Can you get those things approved? Can you get the infrastructure in place? Do you have those headwinds? Are they insurmountable? Does the market warrant the end of day sales price that it would take to get it to that? So that's why a lot of times on the East Coast, you'll see much more spot building because it just doesn't make sense. It's too much to ask of a local jurisdiction. It's also much more fragmented back there. The landowners don't want to part with their land if the value of it is a tenth of what they thought because it's just not a commercially viable venture to develop it into whatever it is. You think about how few players there are in any industry, and in our other episode where we talked about how many publicly traded home builders there are just nationwide and how many homes they put out and how much they can corner the market. One large publicly traded company in our market controls about 20% of new rooftops, and I won't name them, but it starts with a D and ends with an R. And they control about, they control about 20% of our market. So yes, the free market should regulate everything, but that's with the assumption that there's enough choice in the market to allow customers to walk with their, to vote with their feet and to say, well, you don't build a sound home, so I'm going to choose this other home. So I understand the need for regulation. Mm-hmm. And I do love the idea that homes are better today than they were 30 or 40 years ago. And I appreciate the energy, the leaps and bounds we've made with energy efficiency and how much more earthquake resistant, fire resistant, weather resistant, age resistant our structures are today versus even 40 years, 30 years in the past, let alone 100 years in the past, where the adage of they don't build them like they used to, which makes my the hair on the back of my neck stand up, because tear apart at home built from 1955. That thing is built out of cardboard and paper. That is so not...
I'm grateful they're not built like that.
You could punch a hole in the siding and your fist would go through into the bedroom. Sometimes they didn't even have insulation. So looking at the other extreme of it, I understand and I have to take a step back and breathe as to give myself context in terms of why we have these regulations. And you can't count on the free market to iron all those hiccups out. Take a trip to a third world country and get in a 1984 Sentra that is your Uber driver and drive through those streets and alleyways that are not regulated. Some are 7 feet wide and some are 70 feet wide. And the structures that are built over top of each other with the laundry hanging out. And you think, well, I don't want zero regulation because this is what it looks like.
Yeah, you don't want. And just the standardized, right? There's a, just to know that, that there is a general safety component that's been considered before
that's
you
right.
showed up.
That's right. It does give you a great sense of comfort to know that. So while we're doing it while we're dealing with the temporary pain of building the structure, which is a 9 to 18 month process, we have to think that structure is going to be there for 100 to 200 to 300 years. We don't know. And there's homes in England that are 500, 600 years old. Mm-hmm. So I understand why. And I wanted to give our viewers that context that I'm not anti-regulation. I love the idea that we have better building standards today than we did even 20, 25 years ago. So that being said, I want to trash the codes for a while.
I think that's a good point to make, though. I mean, it isn't an anti-regulation. It's a hurdle crossing.
It is. And I think what does get a little frustrating is that there's never a push to cut any regulations at all. That is so unpopular. And there's really no will in the regulatory agencies because by doing that, they're shrinking their footprint. So the Department of Building and Safety wants robust codes. It's job security. And most home building permits are minimum of $5,000, not really right. could go up to $12,000, $15,000, $18,000, $20,000. And you look at a municipality like Clark County, now it's broken up. Sometimes the city of Henderson gets that permit fee or, you know, there's always, county always collects a certain impact fee, but there's always something collected on every rooftop. And we know that last year we built around 12,500 rooftops.
Multiply that by the
by 10,000, and my math doesn't even go. Yeah, my mind doesn't work in numbers that commas that long. So I think that we have to remember that there are some perverse motives that people don't want to see regulations, any regulations, rolled back. In fact, they have a vested interest in increasing regulations, and I feel that certain agencies locally might exist for that purpose. And you might see them growing for the sake of growth. So I thought of something last week that I found exceptionally clever, but you might not.
I sure will.
Regulations, i.e. building codes in our industry, is kind of like a garden. And once you plant it, the garden just keeps growing and germinating a bigger garden, right? And of course, it wants to grow bigger. It's just naturally plants and weeds want to grow. It's not all crop. It's just growth. So if you have a garden and you're watering it, it'll grow. It might not be the stuff you want. Yeah. So you could make a case for that garden and say,
it's choked out by the weeds.
It's choked out by the weeds. And that's kind of how I feel that many times when I'm scratching my head or beating my head against a wall, quite frankly. I wish I was only scratching it. It's not, it's a lot of that. It feels like regulation and regulation for regulation's sake. And I think that that's where my biggest frustrations come from, because I believe in the spirit of regulations and I believe in the spirit of building codes. But I did a little exercise on our local Clark County building codes. And what is referenced on a general set of stamped blueprints that I submit to the city? And without boring our readers, I'm going to bore them. 2021 International Building Code, 2018 Universal Mechanical Code, 2018 International Energy Efficiency Code, 2018 International Residential Code, 2018 Uniform Plumbing Code, 2021 International Wildland Urban Interface Code.
I don't know what that is.
2020, we'll talk about that. 2021 International Fire Code, 2017 National Electric Code, and the 2009 ICC, which is kind of an accessibility, how structures are accessible to the population. These all have to be referenced on a set of plans that we've reviewed these plans to these codes. Then I did a little exercise, if our audience is still awake, as to how many pages those codes encompass total. If you had to just guess all those codes, how many pages, if we printed them out, how many pages would all those codes take up? How many reams of paper?
I'd say probably 500 pages. I mean, if you're looking, it would sum up to...
You libertarian, there is no way in hell it's only 500 pages. take it back. There is no way. It is 4,912,000. Pages of code.
4,912
pages of code. That's pages of code.
Wow.
If you printed out all the codes that I just mentioned, mind you, those are the codes in their entirety. All of our codes have a parentheses that says with local amendments. So 2021 International Building Code with local amendments. So that's saying, yes, all of these codes, we're also going to amend it to our codes that pertain to this. So the Uniform Plumbing Code is something that is observed nationwide. But then Clark County, our local jurisdictions, your local jurisdictions are going to have additional overlays and amendments on top of that. I would imagine that's another 300-400 pages. We're over 5,000 pages of code. The design process is when you have an architect revisions back and forth and back and forth, sign off on that set of architecturals, and then it goes through all the engineering. And there are approximately 5 engineers that touch the home during the design process and the pre-permitting process. Concurrently, if you're in an HOA, while you're doing that, you're generally getting your HOA design review board to sign off on your design.
They take a long time. So you want to start that early?
Usually, yeah. Once you have a set of plans, you're going to meet with your design review board and your HOA if you have one. And they're going to see if your plans kind of fit from a technical standpoint. And then also, do they match with the theme of the neighborhood? And I have a lot of back and forth with
HOAs. And it can be a lengthy process.
It can be a very lengthy process.
Depending on the criteria within that HOA.
That's right.
Some, as you mentioned, some are really strict and some are a little more fluid. And often we're building in an area where there isn't any HOA.
Exactly. And those are, you're tailoring your homes to taste. And it's true free market at its best. Just saying, okay, what does the market want? And with construction, especially when you're in the pre-planning and in the pre-permitting phase, you're a solid 18 to 24 months away from that home being sold. And probably, you know, 3 months before that, you're marketing it. So you're trying to predict, where's the market going to be? What does the market want in terms of size and price point? Number one, what do they want in terms of style? Number two, and then once you parse it down from there, okay, do they want next gen living? Do they want space for mother-in-laws? Do they want 4-car garages? Do they want accessory structures, depending on the scale and scope of the house? You're taking all that into consideration. Once you've signed off on everything design-wise, as I mentioned, it sees 5 different engineers. It's going to see an electrical engineer to lay out the electrical schematic and do the load calculations. It's going to see a plumbing engineer that's going to draw where all the gas lines, waste lines, and supply lines go. It's going to have an HVAC, what we call a mechanical engineer. These plans are called MEPs or MEPs. So that's 3 engineers right there. And then you'll have your structural engineer after your soils engineer. That's why I hesitated to say 5, because you could argue it's 6. because we have a soils engineer that goes out and bores the soil and does compaction tests and says, okay, your footers need to be this deep and your load bearing on this soil, maybe the soil needs to come out, which we call over-exing. You're over-excavating it and then putting it back at a more compacted. And usually having third-party engineers test that during construction and or watch it, what we call lifts. So usually every foot, that's down the road. That's once we've broken ground. But those are the things that are called out during those tests between the structural engineer talking with the geotechnical engineer, working along with the architect and the MEP engineer. So they all do need to talk to each other. And then the other engineer, the final engineer, would be your civil engineer, is creating your grading plan and creating your site plan and showing where all the water is going to go and how the home is going to sit and how high the pad elevations are. And that's your last engineer. And then you submit that to the city and there's rigorous plan checks. You might spend another 3 to 4 months getting your building permit issued. So they're checking all those engineering designs and drawings, and they're basically calling out things that either contradict the drawing or contradict one of the other professions' drawing, or is not in code, or it's a labeling convention. That is one of my biggest pet peeves, when something gets sent back to you because it was just labeled wrong.
And they fine tooth comb it in a way that keeps everything in sync, but also this T wasn't crossed, or this, you know, I mean, there are some really
very meticulous
things that don't necessarily affect the end result,
no,
but certainly slow that portion of the process.
100%. And in our jurisdiction, they have 21 days once you submit things. So every time you get a correction, you've lost 3 weeks.
You start back.
So you pretty much start back, and they definitely
21 days starts back.
It starts all over again, and they reserve the right to find new things.
And sometimes it's being reviewed by a different person.
Many times
so
it is.
So the new things might not necessarily be something that
just something that someone else saw
in the first round. It may not even be wrong, just hot point for that particular reviewer.
So those are the biggest things that kind of slow us down. So when we say it's 6 to 10 months of pre-shovel work, you can see how quickly that adds up. If you're spending a month just figuring out what you want to build there, and then a month with your architect, and then 2 to 3 weeks worth of revisions with that architect because what he sent back wasn't exactly what you had in mind, or as time has progressed, you've decided something else is important to you, or you forgot about something. So we're generally seeing it with the architect for 2 to 2.5 months. So we're already at 3.5 months, and then it's going to sit with the engineers, and you'll have to have surveys done, topographical surveys and soils testing, and those things all take time. And the 800-pound gorilla in the room is that they cost a lot of money. At the end of the day, we're looking at anywhere between $12 and $13 per square foot. So if I'm building a 4,000-square-foot home, I'm spending on the order of $60,000 before my permit. And then the permit is generally based on the size of the home, how many fixtures are in it. So your permit is, in our market, is generally, on a home like that, another $8,000 to $10,000. And plan check fees are another $1,500. HOAs usually charge a fee. So on one of our luxury homes in South Shore in like Las Vegas is just an example.
Okay.
Between the HOA and the permitting and all of the professions that go into the engineering and architecture, it's around $100,000 before I move my first speck of dirt. $100,000.
Just a home on paper. That's all.
Just a home on paper plus $500,000 lot or $400,000 lot. Right. So there's a lot of guts and glory that goes into before you've mobilized your first labor on site.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely a trying, challenging industry. And then the horizon of time. You're looking at 6 to 8 months. It takes a lot of patience.
Thanks for tuning into the Trust the Process podcast. Make sure to follow us on Spotify to stay in the loop with the latest insights, project updates, and everything in between. See you next time.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.